So the next talk is from Julie Thériault, who is coming to us from the University of Washington. And Julie will tell us about a race to identity, which is very interesting and mysterious. Thank you very much, Julie.
Thank you. I'd like to start off, of course, by thanking Thomas and Jean-François for organizing this meeting and for inviting me to come. This is actually the first time I've been at an in-person scientific conference since the beginning of the pandemic, and I couldn't think of a better way to break that fast than to come to Paris to talk about cell motility. So thank you so much for organizing this and setting it up. This is going to be something of a change of pace compared to the talks that we've had so far this morning. Our last two talks from Pierre and Raphael focus very much on the mechanics of motility from a physics perspective. But I think one of the things that is certainly fascinating to me about cell motility as a field of study is that really a comprehensive understanding of this phenomenon requires that we consider not only the physics of the process, but also detailed biology of the process, specifically in appreciating the fact that all of the mechanical properties of cells, including things like the actin polymerization rate, the contractility, their ability to exert forces on their environment, things that we've heard about all morning, all of these are dependent on the activity of specific molecules that are expressed in cells. And behavioral differences among different types of motile cells can, in many cases, be attributed to differences in the presence or the activity levels of these critical protein factors that are required and sufficient for motility. So the project that I want to talk to you about today is a brand new project in my group that is almost completely the work of a single postdoctoral fellow, Nathan Beliveau. And Nathan joined my group a couple of years ago, and he had come from a background in studying gene transcription in bacteria, actually working with Rob Phillips at Caltech. And Nathan was particularly disappointed that we didn't really have any very good genetic systems for studying motility in mammalian cells. Now, there have, of course, been screens done to identify genes associated with motility in other kinds of systems, including, for example, in Drosophila, various different kinds of contractile and motile systems in Drosophila, and some smaller scale screens in model systems like Dictyostelium. But for mammalian cells, and specifically for mammalian neutrophils, or white blood cells, there hadn't really been any technologies that would enable completely unbiased genome scale screens to identify all of the factors involved in motility. So that was Nathan's goal, really, when he joined my lab, was to develop the technology specifically so that we could, in an unbiased way, identify genes that are involved in migration of human neutrophils. So just to orient you to the neutrophils, this is currently my lab's favorite system for studying cell motility because it's extremely versatile, and neutrophils are able to migrate in a variety of different contexts in different ways. So normally in humans, neutrophils are found circulating in the bloodstream where they're just round and non-adhesive, but when they receive a signal, for example, from an infection that's taken place somewhere outside of the bloodstream, the neutrophils initially adhere to the surface of the blood vessels and roll along the blood vessel surface. Then they adhere strongly and extravasate between the endothelial cells lining the blood vessel into the matrix of the deeper tissue. And then they're able also to migrate through that three-dimensional matrix. And one thing that's kind of fun about neutrophils is you can see if you force them to migrate in different kinds of geometries or different kinds of environments, their behavior changes a great deal. So we just heard from Pierre about one-dimensional motility. You can force neutrophils to perform one-dimensional motility by putting them into narrow microfluidic channels, and then they move in an extremely polarized way, really for indefinite lengths of time. More commonly, people study motility of neutrophils in two-dimensional assays, like the classic example shown here of a human neutrophil in a blood smear that's chasing after this little bacterium in order to eventually phagocytose it. So in this kind of two-dimensional motility, neutrophils, for the most part, remain very well polarized with a single leading edge. But when neutrophils get into a three-dimensional environment, which more closely resembles what they see when they get into tissues outside of the bloodstream, then their behavior is much more complex. So this beautiful movie is from Lillian Fritz Leyland using light sheet microscopy to show the migration of an HL60 cell, which is a human neutrophil-like cell line, in a collagen matrix. And here you can't see the collagen, you can just see it's scattered around like this. You can just see the outline of the cell. What you can see is the movement is, of course, a lot less persistent and is also associated with a lot of formation and retraction of protrusions as the cell tries to navigate this complex environment. So in addition to all these different kinds of motility, there are multiple questions about how these things are regulated, how they interact with their environments, as we've seen beautiful examples about how cells can degrade chemoattractants in their environment, or in some cases even secrete their own chemoattractants, or modulate the physics of their matrix using contractility. And again, all of these come down to roles of specific proteins. So for the part of neutrophil motility that my lab is focused on historically, which is just the protrusion of the leading edge, that's largely driven by actin polymerization, using what's thought to be basically the same familiar scheme that has been identified through the combination of biochemical and genetic methods in a wide variety of different motile systems. And we can show in neutrophils that all of these same factors that are critical for formation of the branched actin network in other systems, for example, in Listeria monocytogenes motility or motility of fish keratocytes, all of those things also are involved in motility of neutrophils. But what we would really like to be able to do is get beyond the molecules that were identified through these more sort of traditional methods and find everything that's involved in neutrophil migration through some form of unbiased screen. And part of the reason for wanting to do this specifically in human neutrophils is because there's lots of other things neutrophils do besides just motility that's also interesting in terms of tracking down the protein factors involved. So, for example, the reason that neutrophils want to leave your bloodstream and crawl out into the tissue if they sense an infection is so that they can find the bacteria or the invading microbes and phagocytose them in order to destroy them. Neutrophils also do this amazing trick where when they find an infectious site with lots of bacteria in it, they crawl up there and they actually vomit out all of their DNA, making what are called nets or extracellular traps that trap the bacteria just by virtue of the extremely sticky nature of DNA and then help the body clear those bacteria by virtue of that sort of suicidal process of dumping out their genome. Neutrophils also do a lot of other interesting cell biology, including things like degranulation, where they save a bunch of sort of murderous enzymes in granules that they dump out when they find a target. So Nathan really wanted to sort of initiate this project in the interest of studying neutrophil motility, but wanted to design his approach in a way that we could use the same method to explore actually other aspects of neutrophil biology today, which I'm not going to go into, but I hope you'll be able to see as I go through how this technology that he's recently developed is going to be able to apply to all of these processes. So the technology that we've settled on for really performing an unbiased genome-wide screen in these mammalian cells is to use a technique called CRISPR-I or CRISPR interference that was originally pioneered by Jonathan Weissman's lab at UCSF. And the idea is that you can take Cas9, which is the enzyme associated with cleaving DNA in the context of CRISPR, and then disable the nucleotide function of it. So dCas9 is just a Cas9 that has its nucleotide function destroyed by a single point mutation. Then you can fuse that enzyme to a repressing domain, and we specifically use the repressing domain of CRAB. And then in a cell line expressing this fusion protein with the dCas9 CRAB construct, you can put in then a library of small guide RNAs that target every cell, every gene in the entire human genome. And from that, make a library of, in this case, HL60 cells that where each one has a different guide. The thing that is really useful about HL60 cells is this is a cell line that was derived from a human promyelocytic leukemia. And so the cells, as you proliferate them, are essentially in an undifferentiated state. But you can add chemical signals to the cells that will drive them into differentiation. And specifically, if you add DMSO to the cells, rather than just proliferating in their undifferentiated state, over the course of about 5 to 7 days, they become very neutrophil-like cells, and it's extremely difficult looking down the microscope to tell the difference between a differentiated HL60 cell and a legitimate human neutrophil that you take out of a human bloodstream. So these neutrophil-like cells, after they're differentiated, we can then perform assays on them to try to identify things that have defects in migration. So first off, Nathan had to actually establish this CRISPR-I method in HL60 cells, and this just shows you a control where he's using a small guide RNA to knock down the protein CD4, which we chose just because it's a common marker for neutrophil expression. And here in the orange trace, you can see the surface level of expression of CD4 is judged by flow cytometry for the differentiated HL60 cells under normal conditions. And then the blue trace here shows the effect after knocking down CD4 with the guide RNA. And you can see it gets knocked down very efficiently, almost down to the level of the isotype control. So the system appears to be really very useful in this human neutrophil-like cell line. And again, this is something we can now do at genome scale. So Nathan's idea for how he was going to go about using this to study cell motility was very simple, which was basically just to make the cells race. So we can now take this population of HL60 cells that have been differentiated to a neutrophil-like phenotype. Each one has a different gene knocked down. And then if we put them in some sort of migratory environment where they have a goal and then let them crawl, there will be some cells where even though they have some gene knocked down, if that gene is not involved in motility, they'll still be able to crawl at the normal rate. Some of them will be somewhat slower and some of them will be unable to crawl at all. And so if we have a quantitative way then to measure who gets to the finish line, we should be able to identify those genes. And the advantage of using this particular molecular approach is we can do this in bulk. So we can take our whole bulk library of cells that are all grown together in a pool, put them through some kind of migration assay in order to separate the ones who can move well from the ones who move poorly, and then just gather the ones who won the race and sequence them in bulk and identify all of the genes who are either overrepresented or underrepresented among the winners on that other end. So on paper, you know, when Nathan first came to my lab and we were sketching out what his project was going to be, this looked really easy. And actually, my original idea of this was that we would literally just use like an agarose gel, but make it out of collagen, put the cells at one end, and then catch the ones who came off the other end. But the problem arises when you start actually doing calculations about the number of cells that you need and the distance that they move to travel. And really, the limiting factor here is the number of cells that you have to go through in order to do a real genome-wide screen. Now, my group, being primarily focused on video microscopy as our primary tool, we're used to doing experiments with a few dozen cells or maybe a few hundred cells. But in order to do this kind of screen, what we had to do was actually measure the migration rates of pools of 50 million cells in order to get appropriate signal to noise. So this was just a very different scale from what we'd ever been used to doing before. So the way that Nathan ended up actually doing this was instead of doing a real migration assay as I drew in the cartoon, instead he set up for the first pass just a very simple transwell assay where we had custom made very large transwell filters that are about 20 microns thick with track etched pores that are 3 microns in diameter. And these are done by bombardment. So the size of the holes is very, very uniform. And then in a large well that we 3D printed, we could mount these membranes, put big pools of cells on top, even up to 50 million cells, and then just capture who comes through on the bottom. And Nathan did this two different ways. One was just to look at chemokinesis with uniform serum, both in the top and in the bottom of the well. And the other was with chemotaxis, where he had no serum in the top part of the well and 10% serum in the bottom. And down here, looking at the quantitation of who comes through, you can see it takes a few hours for a reasonable fraction of the cells to get across the membrane in this system. And this here is drawn to scale. So you can see, you know, the 20 micron thick membrane, the cells really do have to actively crawl some distance down these little tunnels in order to make it into the bottom. With no directional signal, but just serum present everywhere, you get about 10% of the cells through after 2 hours and about 20% through after 6 hours. With the gradient, there's a modest improvement both at 2 hours and at 6 hours, but it's not really night and day. I mean, mostly the neutrophils are just crawling, regardless of whether there's a gradient or not. But then the fun begins when we can then capture the ones who won at the end of that and start sequencing them to find out what the knockdown cells are whose representation has changed when they get to the end of the race. So I also mentioned, because these cells start off in the proliferative non-differentiated form, we actually make the library in that proliferative form. And so it's very easy in this context also to identify all of the genes that are associated with HL60 proliferation. And we can do that just by making the library, letting the cells grow for a little while, and then counting the abundance of the sgRNAs who show up after a couple of weeks of proliferation compared to those who showed up before. And we get actually a very large number of hits that decrease proliferation of these cells and a handful that increase proliferation. And this was very comforting to us, actually, because people have now, over the past couple of years, used this technology to measure cell proliferation in a variety of other mammalian cell lines. And so there are a lot of usual suspects that show up, including, as you would expect, things that are associated with DNA replication or things that are associated with the cell cycle, where if you knock them down, you have a decrease of proliferation. And Nathan basically found all of those same things in HL60s. So we think our library is good. We think our method is good. And proliferation of these HL60 cells is very much just garden variety proliferation, as it's been described for other mammalian cells. We can also find genes that are involved in differentiation, just in terms of who survives for those 5 to 7 days after treatment with the chemical agent, in particular DMSO, that triggers differentiation of these cells. And here it's interesting that we have sort of a balance between the number of genes that decrease differentiation and number of genes that actually increase differentiation. That is, genes where when you knock them down, those knockdowns are overrepresented in the differentiation pool. And this is an interesting story that I don't have time to go into today, but there are a number of things that actually seem to enhance differentiation, or more specifically, the survival of differentiated cells in this population. Today, I really want to focus on our hits from cell migration. Here you can see the numbers are relatively small compared to the numbers for proliferation or differentiation. Again, most of the hits that affect cell migration are things that decrease migration through the Transwell assay rather than increase it. But there's a good number of them. So in this coincidence plot over here, Nathan has indicated how many genes there are in each of these different categories, either that affect proliferation only, about 1,200, things that affect differentiation only, about 700, things that affect both proliferation and differentiation. And then this group here is the ones that only affect migration without affecting either of the other processes that we studied. So this is about 300 genes now that exhibit a specific phenotype with respect to migration across this Transwell assay. So let's now dig in a little bit into what those things are that we identified. So I'm going to show you a couple of plots where we have the full change in the migration assay. On the vertical axis is going to be that chemokinesis assay, where there's serum present on both sides of the filter, and it just measures essentially whether or not the cells are able to move. And then compare that to the chemotaxis assay, where there's serum only on one side of the filter, and so the cells are moving in a more directed manner. And our controls here are within this large population of guide RNAs, about 500 guide RNAs that are deliberately designed to not target any genes. So we have a large built-in negative control for every experiment. And on these plots, the axes are normalized log-fold change compared to the input. So we've gotten rid of everything that is affected in differentiation or proliferation. We're just counting the guides that show up in that differentiated pool. And then measure essentially how many copies of that knockdown line are in the top part of the well versus the bottom part of the well. And anything that's close to zero is average in the population. And so you can see all of our 500 control genes are nicely clustered around zero, and this also gives you a sense of sort of the level of noise that's present in this system. So now if we look at the ones that are actually targeted against genes rather than just controls, we see a pattern that looks like this. So there's a couple of things that are very striking here. The thing that's most striking to me is that this really is a beautiful diagonal line, meaning that essentially all of the genes that have an effect on chemotaxis have an equivalent effect on chemokinesis. That is, we're not really pulling out things that are specifically involved in directed motility as opposed to motility writ large. And I think that has interesting implications that I'm happy to discuss at the end. The other thing that I want to particularly draw your attention to is that there's a big long tail of really, really strong effects down here on the negative end of both sides. That is, most of our hits, as I mentioned before, are things that strongly inhibit the ability of the cells to migrate through this membrane. There are a couple that make migration more effective, more efficient, but really the majority are negative effects, which I think most of us would have expected. And if we look at what those genes are, the very strongest hit that we get here is actually integrin beta 2. And our second strongest hit is TALEN, which is also associated with adhesions, with formation of focal adhesions in cells. So a lot of the hits ended up actually affecting expression of the integrins specifically required for adhesion of the neutrophils to the surface in these assays. So this shows a couple of individual knockdown lines that Nathan made in order to validate these effects. The one in the middle here is just the control with a control guide RNA, and this is what motility looks like for these HL60 cells at relatively high resolution. If we take one of the strongest hits of this knockdown of integrin beta 2, you can see the cell is sort of, you know, trying to move. It's actually fairly polarized and is wiggling around pretty well, but because it's not able to adhere to the substrate in this 2D assay, of course, it just can't go anywhere. And then on the right here, you see an interesting example of something called folliculin, which also has a knockdown in its ability to crawl across the membrane. But here you see it's actually much more adhesive than normal. They spread out a lot more. And these also are unable to get across the membrane, although in this case we think it's because they adhere too well to the membrane and so they don't make it through into the well at the bottom. So looking through all of the hits, of which there are, as I said, about 300, we can find there's fairly strong negative effects really for pretty much all of the components that you would expect to be involved in the construction of these adhesion complexes. We also found a bunch of other hits that were involved specifically in protein trafficking, at least that was what the gene annotation told us. And one of the either fun or distressing things about doing unbiased genetic screens is you have to just follow up whatever the hits are, regardless of whether or not it's a pathway you're particularly interested in. So I knew, I'm going to say exactly nothing about protein trafficking before Nathan started getting these hits out. But of course, we had to look up what these things were. And it turns out a lot of the hits where we had really fairly strong negative changes in terms of inability to crawl across the membrane are involved in protein trafficking complexes of various different kinds with these names, retromer, retriever, Hopps complex, and Corvette complex. And to make a long story short, we think that a lot of them actually have a primary effect because they also affect the expression of the integrins, essentially the ability to get to the surface. So for example, here in this experiment, Nathan was able to measure using flow cytometry the expression of integrin alpha M, which is one of the other ones where he got a strong hit, and integrin beta 2 that I've already mentioned. Here, this just shows the controls where the black line shows the normal expression level of the integrins and the light gray is the isotype control, which is the negative. And it turns out if he knocks down just the beta 1 integrin or the beta 2 integrin, that also causes a really dramatic decrease in the expression of the alpha M integrin. So that kind of effect has been seen before in integrins and other protein complexes where knocking down one actually ends up affecting expression of all of them. The thing that's kind of cool here is that some of these other genes that he found, particularly this really, really strong effect of something called VPS29, ends up also decreasing by about 10-fold or up to 100-fold the expression of these integrin subunits, presumably because their trafficking during synthesis is affected. So we're now trying to track down sort of how much of this effect is solely due to expression of the integrins as opposed to other, other proteins that are presented on the cell surface. But at this point, it occurred to Nathan that he really probably should do some other kinds of assays besides simply this Transwell assay, because it seemed like to us we weren't really studying migration, we were really studying adhesion using this assay. So to set up a different kind of assay, and one that would better reflect what the neutrophils are actually doing in vivo, he came up with this clever idea of seeding cells onto a cover slip mixed together with collagen. So you can just paint a very thin layer of collagen on a large cover slip, with neutrophils embedded in it. And then he overlaid that layer of collagen with a layer of fibrin, which is the main protein that makes clots. And then let some time go by, about 8 hours, and then cells that started off in the collagen are able to migrate up into the fibrin layer. And the thing that's useful about this for these very large-scale experiments, and again, we have to do 50 million cells in order to get data out of this, is that you can then use an enzyme that specifically degrades the fibrin to release the cells that have been able to crawl. And then you can do the same thing of sequencing them and counting the representation of sgRNAs that are defective or that are enhanced with respect to 3D motility. So now looking at those results, here on the vertical axis, this is the chemokinesis results I've shown you before. And on the horizontal axis, these are the hits from this amoeboid assay in 3D extracellular matrix. And you can see that there's a lot of things that are in this negative zone for both kinds of assays. But specifically, I want to draw your attention to these guys down here that were our strongest hits in the Transwell assay actually have only very low effects in the 3D assay. And in contrast, we have other candidates here like this formin-like protein, which show up very strongly in the 3D assay but have relatively modest hits in the Transwell assay. And this is identified as a formin-like protein, but its localization inside of the cells actually seems to be behind the nucleus where the neutrophil is being squeezed. So we're just beginning to follow up a couple of these other cell types, or a couple of these other genes to find out what they're doing in the context of the 3D assay. So I just want to leave you with some brand new stuff that's really hot off the presses, where Nathan has now taken the same approach and applied it to a different kind of cue for cell migration, and specifically to the process of galvanotaxis, or migration in electric field. So it's been known, that's supposed to be 1886, it's been known for well over 100 years that almost all migratory cells will respond to the presence of an electric field. And the vast majority move towards the cathode or move towards the negative pole. But there are some cases of cells that move to the anode, some cases where you can switch the direction, so it seems like it is a regulated behavior. And previously we had mostly studied this in keratocytes from fish skin, where if you turn on an electric field, you can force the cells to turn gradually by extending lamellar podium in an asymmetric direction. Whereas with the neutrophils, what Nathan found was that when you turn on the electric field, essentially they retract their old protrusions and start protruding in a new direction. And just like with other cells that are able to undergo galvanotaxis, we can do large-scale quantitative assays on this, track the cells, and it turns out that the responsive neutrophils also to an electric field is strongly dependent on field strength and has all the other characteristics of being a properly controlled migratory cue. Now, my former student, Greg Allen, working with Alex McGillner, who's here, had studied this in keratocytes some years ago, and for various indirect reasons, we concluded the most likely explanation was that the electric field induced redistribution of highly charged, sialated membrane components that then would signal to the inside of the cell in order to reorient the cytoskeleton and have them move. So in order to do this in the neutrophils, we had to build a device, and I'm just about out of time, so I won't go through all the details here, but there was a huge amount of troubleshooting in this to avoid all of the problems of electrochemistry when you put them across cells, things like electrical heating. So we've got a fairly elaborate set of devices now that was built by Matthew Footer, where we can generate an electric field across a transwell filter and do the same kind of assays that I described before. So these are, like I said, this is hot off the press. None of these have actually been confirmed yet. But one thing that's really dramatic is we find a huge number of hits, besides the usual suspects that have shown up in our other screens, a huge number of hits that are associated with glycoprotein quality control and with synthesis of glycosaminoglycans and N-glycans. And so at least our first read of this is that this is, on the face of it, very consistent with the idea that sugar-coated, highly charged membrane proteins are the key to cells being able to detect the movement of electric field. And obviously, we're very excited to follow those up and see exactly what their defects are in electric field migration as compared to other forms of migration, including chemotaxis. So I know this is too much to look at, but I just want to let everybody here know that we're now building these gene lists where we can quantitatively assess the contributions of all of the genes in the human genome to migrations of neutrophils in multiple different contexts, the chemotaxis chemokinesis context, the galvanotaxis context, and also migration ECM. And there's a lot of things that turn out to be important in all contexts, and then there are quite a few things of particular interest that are important in one context or the other. So I'll end there. Mostly I wanted to share with this group that it is now actually possible to do completely unbiased genetic screens in mammalian cells associated with migration. And as the results are just rolling off the sequencing machine, we've got at least 300 that are specific for cell migration in neutrophils that do not affect other aspects of growth or proliferation or differentiation. And Nathan has been doing an amazing job of working out large-scale assays. So you can put 50 million cells at a time through migratory assays to get this kind of data. And I hope you'll appreciate that we can also now use the same approach to other aspects of neutrophil biology. And we're particularly interested in phagocytosis at present, but hope to move into these other directions as well. So to end, again, this was essentially all the work of a single postdoctoral fellow with technical help from Matthew Footer, building the galvanotaxis device, and beautiful immunofluorescence done by Aaron Van Leeuwen. And I will thank you for your attention and happy to take questions.